Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
I think they have a very inspirational legacy, and I hope that other people feel inspired by it as well. And that's part of the reason why I also started writing this book. They had to endure a lot, but they succeeded in overcoming all the barriers, all the challenges, all the difficulties that other people put in their way. I think that he's such a powerful person, and he can be such an inspiration for other people. Like, you can endure if you dedicate your mind to it.
Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Samuel Decourt is a graduate student of Utrecht University, where he studied an MA in the cultural history of modern Europe. He wrote his master's thesis about the representation of Black Americans during World War II, indicating that they formed a substantial part of the American armed forces, but they don't receive an equal share in the representation in contemporary media. We're going to talk about his latest book on the Tuskegee Airmen. So Samuel, welcome to Extended.
Yes, thank you, Peter, for having me on the show.
No, it's delightful to have you on the show. Whereabouts are you calling us from, Samuel?
I'm in the Netherlands, Utrecht. It's in the middle of the Netherlands, like right in the middle.
Right, okay. Well, maybe that'll pop up later because of my Dutch heritage, but we'll park that one for the moment because I'm really interested in the book, but I'm fascinated in how you came to this topic and how you decided to write not only your thesis, but then the book that followed that. How did this subject come to you?
It's a good question. Long story short, it actually started with Wikipedia. There's another black unit, and I write books about black American units during the Second World War. And it actually sparked my curiosity. It's the 452nd Anti-Aircraft Artillery Battalion. It's an anti-aircraft unit, as the name, of course, implies. But it was just a short paragraph. It was like, 10 sentences or something. And I was rather surprised because if you look for this unit online, people will say like, yeah, this is one of the most famous black units, or people often mention this unit in online discussions. And I was very curious because people use it as an example, but there's very little information on them available. And that actually made me dive deeper into the topic, like, why is there so little information about them available? And from there it evolved, so is it because of the sources, which is a factor, but also because of how people portray certain actions during the Second World War? Many of the Black American soldiers served in service units or in supporting units, quartermaster corps, signal corps, port battalions. Whereas, for instance, the focus in movies is often on the battles, the conflicts, in which they played a lesser role.
So let me just ask you to go back one moment. And if you don't mind me saying, you don't appear to be black. Why does the topic of black servicemen appeal to you? Where does that come from?
I think there's many factors. On one hand, it is... So I wrote my thesis, and after my thesis, I was thinking like I identified a problem, and I'm sure that people recognize it from school or from university. It's like, okay, you write an essay or you write a proposal to a problem and then you move on to the next class or the next topic.
Yeah.
But still, this stuck in the back of my mind. I was like, okay, this is a problem I identified and I want to do something about it. And that's right. Why I started writing about Black American units.
Okay. Well, let's talk about, let's go back to the US and talk about Black American military personnel. You start off by taking the reader further back, and I'm interested to understand a bit more for those who are not probably from the US, who Jim Crow was and why that features in the title of your book.
So Jim Crow, there was a lot of segregation in the US at the time. And that segregation was partially entrenched in laws. So certain laws said, Black people could not use this car to, Black people could not use this train car, or Black people had to use these toilets and white people had to use these toilets. A lot of these laws are racist, and because of this racism, they were sometimes referred to as Jim Crow laws, because Jim Crow was a caricature. It was a character that was used to mock Black American people, and for this reason, these laws also got this name, because it was a caricature of these people. I'm pronouncing that wrong.
No, it's okay.
What I mean is that,
I understand. Yeah, I understand. Yeah, they use it as a caricature of.
And what I mean is that it doesn't apply to them as humans. It doesn't see them as humans. It sees them as a figure, as a comical figure or something, which is not a representation of who they are.
Yeah, so dogfighting with the Luftwaffe and with Jim Crow makes sense. So going back, I was fascinated to read about World War One and what was it, Eugene Bullard, and also learn about a Jamaican pilot who fought for the British called William Robinson Clark. So, but flying was still off limits for most Americans, Black Americans, wasn't it? And until the change in the legislation in, I think it was 1939, the Civilian Pilot Training Act, that was it, came in. Did that open doors then for Black Americans to be able to train as military pilots, or where did the opportunity then first come for Black Americans to join the U.S. Air Force?
The opportunity didn't come to them immediately, because there were certain Black universities, but the civilian pilot training program did not immediately apply to them. And it was only after they pushed for it themselves, so they asked, like, we want to be included into this program, that at certain Black universities, this program got started, and that's how they managed to become pilots. Although in the first few cases, it was actually quite difficult. I'm thinking about Benjamin O. Davis, who would eventually become the commander of the 332nd Fighter Group. When he finished his military education at West Point, a prestigious military academy in the U.S. Army, he applied for the Air Forces, but he was told that there was simply not a unit to which he could be assigned. And instead, he had to do something else. And it was only later, after the program got started and the first Black American unit was established, it was the 99th Fighter Squadron, that was when he could get started. That was when they could begin training for their own squadron, so to say.
And in those early days, there were still significant challenges, weren't there, for the airmen? Segregation still existed, and the challenge outside of the training program still existed. But in some instances, they were being supervised and, I suppose, managed, we'd use the term, by pretty racist white officers as well, weren't they?
Yes. And one of the problems in the early days of the unit was that they didn't know where to put the unit. So it was a black squadron, but usually squadrons fight as part of a fighter group. So it's like three squadrons together. And they weren't sure what to do with them. Would they keep this unit in the US until two other black squadrons had been trained? And then the unit as a group would go overseas and be deployed? Or was the idea, and that's eventually what they did, the black squadron would go overseas and it would be attached to a white fighter group.
Right. Okay. And just coming back again to their training, there were all sorts of myths and unpleasantness around black Americans training to fly, and much of that was in the traditional media, but also in strong held beliefs of many of the individuals around them that A, they weren't capable of training to be pilots or training to be airmen or training to be engineers or whatever. Because this isn't just about the pilots. This is about the whole air crew and the whole support crew as well. But also there was an awful lot of we can't deploy them because we don't believe that they will be they will fight and stand up for the American ethos or the Allied ethos. There was all these ridiculous claims flying around that stopped those squadrons being deployed.
Yes, that's true. And the difficult part was that they needed to prove themselves. They needed to prove themselves every step of the way. So it wasn't just they needed to have the intelligence to fly a plane, but they needed to do everything. So there was a separate unit, and it was for the ground personnel that was attached to the 99th Fighter Squadron, and later the 332nd Fighter Group. And they needed to train their own mechanics. They needed to train their own weather officers. Like, they needed to, especially in the case of the 477th Bombardment Group, it was another black American unit. I'm sure that we'll talk about it later. And they needed to train everything themselves. They needed to really, like, start from the ground up. And that was also one of the problems they encountered later, because the units didn't, especially the 99th Fighter Squadron, it didn't have veteran officers when it went into combat. So the other units, often they were already in the theater, or certain officers from other units joined them, and then they would be sent into combat. So they had some experienced men. They had some people who had been in combat before. But in the case of the 99th Fighter Squadron, this wasn't the case. And for them, it was a problem because the first time they encounter combat, it's, of course, a lot different. Like, you can train for countless hours, but the first time you enter combat, it's always different than how you expect it to be.
Yeah.
And that's why, for instance, the lack of skilled officers in the unit is a problem for them.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the characters during that training. We mentioned one or two there, but you pick out some in the book as well. You pick out their stories. You know, they were real pioneers. They were breaking the mold every single way, but they were real characters in their own right as well, weren't they?
Yes. One of the most impressive men I've read about is Benjamin O. Davis Jr. He is, at first, the commander of the 99th Fighter Squadron. He gets sent home to deal with certain charges that are made against this unit. Later, he returns with the 332nd Fighter Group, and eventually he goes back to the US again to take charge of the 477th bombardment group. And he had to go through a lot of difficult experiences just to get where he was. There were all kinds of negative remarks, racist comments, people doubting them, and he had to stand up against all of it. I remember that during his training at West Point, he was silenced. So what happened is that outside of the mandatory issues, outside of the mandatory classes, people wouldn't speak to him. And he had to endure it for several years. And I'm trying to imagine it. Like, imagine being silenced like that and going through all of it.
And not being spoken to at all, was he? And the only time he was communicated with was when he was instructed or an officer told him to do something or part of a course. Yes. Outside of that, nobody spoke to him at all, as you say, for several years. But he makes the point, you know, he decided to use that as his strength to drive himself forwards. But that must have been so, so hard.
Yeah, it must have been horrible what he had to endure. And also later, when he's again a commanding officer, he is in charge of the 99th Fighter Squadron. And a report gets sent back, made by the commanding officer of the 33rd Fighter Group. And it contains negative remarks about the 99th Fighter Squadron, the unit Davis is in charge of.
Yeah.
And he's recalled back to the US to deal with these charges. And imagine, like, you're going into combat, like, you're trying to stand up for your soldiers, you're trying to stand up for your men, and then someone makes these kind of remarks about it. It's horrible. It's like the accusations were that the unit would disintegrate under fire, that the unit didn't function as a whole. And part of it is, of course, logical, because they had only been in combat a few times, and for them it was like new. The other units, as I mentioned before, they had experienced officers or trained veterans
who
were with them. But for them, it was the first time in combat. So, of course, it's, like I said, it's different than how you expect it.
Yeah. So what were they, just before we come to deployment, what were the aircraft that they were originally flying when they were first deployed?
They flew the P-40. And the 332nd Fighter Group, they are most well known for the P-51 Mustang. As for the 477 Bombardment Group, they operated in the Mitchell Bomber. B-25, if I'm correct.
Okay. So where were they deployed? Where were they first deployed? Because there's, I think most people's impressions, if they've even seen the film, is from the recent films about the topic. But how were they deployed? Where were they deployed? And what time of this was it in the war? Because it wasn't right at the beginning of the war, was it? It was midway through.
That's true. So they were deployed in Africa. If I'm correct, November 1942.
And Samuel, was there a reason sorry to interrupt you there. Was there a reason that they were sent to Africa first?
A good question. I do not know. I do know that they were attached to the 33rd Fighter Group because that unit had suffered losses.
Right.
As for them being deployed over there, I think it's the most logical place for them to be deployed. What I mean is that I'm thinking about like the fighting in the Pacific at that time, which might not be suitable for the P-40 that they were flying in.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing it's part of the reason why they were sent over there.
Okay, no, it was just a question. I don't think I picked that up. But, I interrupted you. They were deployed to North Africa originally, weren't they?
Yeah.
And how did their early action unfold?
So they were attached to the 33rd fighter group. And at first they were assigned as part of this unit. And it was a bit of a complicated situation because the first few times in combat, as I said before, is of course different than how you expect it to be. They were involved in the campaign over Sicily, as well as the Pantarellian campaign. It's one of the first times that an island surrendered due to the use of air force. So what happens is that it's a small island near Italy, and it was bombed by Allied aircraft, and eventually the island just surrendered because they couldn't take it anymore. Later, the unit, the 99th Fighter Squadron, was employed near Sicily, and eventually, as the Allies advanced throughout Italy, so they were in Sicily, and then they went across and then up the boot of Italy, so to say, they were deployed alongside of them. So they moved up, or their missions were performed further on the Italian front.
Did you know that in the late 1940s, during atomic weapons testing in the Pacific, the USA used Boeing B-17 Flying Fortresses as unmanned radio-controlled drones? Did you also know that in 1927, two RAF officers in a Hawker Horsley set a new distance record, flying from Britain to the Persian Gulf, only for it to be eclipsed just hours later by Charles Lindbergh's solo Atlantic crossing, which was a mere 180 miles longer? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. If your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
G'day, I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran from Plane Crazy Down Under.
And you're listening to Extended.
As you've referred to quite a few times, they were very naive with regard to combat tactics and combat issues. But they picked it up really, really quickly, didn't they? They got to grips pretty quickly. There was almost, or I felt in some of the stories of their initial action, that they had to work harder, if that's possible when you're in combat, to justify their performance. But they did that very quickly. How well were they received by the support units and the other elements of the squadrons they were working with?
As for the other squadrons, Spike Momyer, he was the officer in charge of the 33rd Fighter Group. He didn't have a good opinion about them. And this opinion might have been a result of racism, because he did other things as well. The one time there was a meeting and he moved the time of the meeting. Benjamin O'Davis arrived too late for the meeting together with another officer. And people have a bad impression about them. But yeah, if you move the meeting, you don't inform people, they cannot arrive on time. After the Momyer report, Benjamin O'Davis was recalled and he had to explain these charges. And they got out actually better as a result, because an investigation was made and it turned out that the charges were false. Meanwhile, the 99th Fighter Squadron was attached to the 79th Fighter Group, so it was another unit. And this unit actually worked very well with them. They taught them different things. And when the unit left again, the 99th Fighter Squadron eventually left this unit, they even had a small farewell party. I'm also thinking about the story. At one time, a pilot went missing, a black pilot of the 99th Fighter Squadron, and the commanding officer of the 79th Fighter Group, he took off together with another pilot to actually search for the pilot.
Right.
And I think things like this are important because they, the pilots know, like, okay, we can trust this officer. Like, he's going to take care of us. He's not just, he doesn't see us as a tool for publication or something.
Yeah. It's quite fascinating as they became more active in combat and started to get their own successes and prove themselves, they became more accepted, didn't they? And became more integrated in the other operating units. Samuel, question I didn't ask you, and I'm not quite sure why I didn't pick this up. When did their red tails and red stripes for their squadrons start to appear? Was that always the case, or was that something that came later?
That wasn't the case in the beginning. It came out later. It was with the 332nd Fighter Group, and that's when they started painting the tails red. There's actually an image of the 99 Fighter Squadron, and they have these jaws painted on the coiling of the aircraft.
Yeah,
makes it look as if it's a very big shark or something.
Yeah. And was that really where they started to get their nickname of the Red Tails?
Yeah. So at first, the nickname was Red Tails, and the nickname Tuskegee Airmen actually came later. It was one of the first people to write a book about the Tuskegee Airmen, as he called them. Francis, his last name slips, escapes me, but he was one of the first people to actually write about them, and he gave them the name, or he gave himself and the others the name, the Tuskegee Airmen.
I noticed actually, Samuel, as we were talking, you never called them the Tuskegee Airmen until then. Oh. Is there a reason for that?
Not particularly. I have the feeling that the Tuskegee Airmen encompasses a lot of people and a lot of different circumstances.
Yeah.
So I'm not just the 99 Fighter Squadron, but also the 332nd Fighter Group, but also the 477 Bombardment Group, I'm sorry, as well as the artillery liaison pilots. So,
and were they all grouped under that banner of the Tuskegee Airmen, or because you know modern media portrays it as the P-51, you know, pilots with the red tails, they're the Tuskegee Airmen, but is the term applied to all of that cohort?
I think it should be. I know that some of the liaison pilots, they were made honorary Tuskegee Airmen. And I know that many of the pilots that went overseas, so they were serving in the 332nd Fighter Group or the 99th Fighter Squadron, they had a lot of respect for the guys that were serving in the Bombardment Group. I think it's best if I explain it real brief what happened there.
Yeah, I think that'd be really useful. Thank you.
So there was a so there was a Black Bombardment Group, and it consisted of four bombardment squadrons. And these guys were in training, and due to racism, they never made it overseas. So there was a racist officer, Selway, from the top of my mind, and he didn't treat them right. And a unit, in order to perform well, it needs to have a good officer. It needs to have someone in charge that can actively lead them instead of hold them back. And what happened is that at that time it was forbidden to segregate officers' clubs. The army regulations in 1945 said that all officers could attend all officers' clubs on the army base. And what he did is he said, we have an officers' club for trainees, and we have an officers club for instructors, and those two are separate. And yeah, it's a violation of army policy. And what some of the guys in training did is they made a peaceful attempt or a non-violent attempt to integrate the officers clubs, because the instructors were all white and the trainees were all black. So what they did is the black officers would go to the white officers club and they would ask for service. Yeah, of course, they wouldn't get it, or they were instructed to leave and they were taken away. And over the course of 2 or 3 days, some 60 officers were eventually arrested because they refused to leave. Later, a declaration was made, and the officers in training, they had to sign it, and it explained to them which clubs they could attend, which ones they couldn't attend. And 101 of these officers refused to sign it. And of course, they were again taken away. And it was seen as an attempted mutiny. And it was a very complicated case, because eventually, like, the press became involved, Congress became involved, and even the army at some point decided, like, we don't really know what to do with it. So it was a bit of, like, dismissed. Eventually, these guys returned to training. The officer, the white officer in charge of the unit, he was replaced. And actually, Benjamin O'Davis, who we spoke about before, he came back. And he took charge of the unit, and it was very difficult because the unit had already spent quite some time in training and morale had been seriously hurt because of these problems. And yeah, to come back to the point, and that's why I mentioned it, there's Charles Dryden. He's one of the Tuskegee Airmen whose experiences have been recorded. He wrote an autobiography about his experiences. And he actually included, like, a list of names. Like, these are the people that refused to sign, or these are the people that were attempting to integrate the club. And the fact is that he was a combat veteran. He had served in combat, and these guys were still in training. But the fact that he included all of their names, it shows a certain amount of respect that he had for them. And I think that's also very important to remember and also to record as part of the Tuskegee Airmen history.
Yeah. Okay. Just bring you back to the bomb groups then. Were they deployed at all? Did they go to service? They didn't go at all.
No. They never went overseas. So the unit, it was a bit of a complicated history because eventually the war in Europe was over. And one of the black squadrons, the black fighter squadrons, was assigned to the bombardment group, and it would become a composite group. And the idea is that by having their own fighters, they would have everything together. So it's like, yeah, they had their own escort in case it was needed. And yeah, the unit was still in training when the war ended in August 1945.
Okay, but before the war ended, they of course in effect followed the battles and became more and more integrated in the Allied responses. They were involved in ground attack, and some of them were shot down as well. And became POWs as black people. How did the Germans respond to that?
It was very difficult, not difficult, but it was very different, because of course they were black. There is one Walter Manning, one Tuskegee Airman. He was lynched, and race probably played a role in it. So he was shot down and he was taken to an Austrian airbase, and eventually he was picked up by 2 Luftwaffe political officers. And it's not entirely sure what happened, but the next morning he was found dead hanging from a tree. And as far as we know, he's the only Tuskegee Airman lynched in Austria during the Second World War. But yeah, there are some other pilots who have disappeared or whose body has never been recovered. So we don't know what happened to them. On the other hand...
How did the Germans treat them other than that? Because there were more black prisoners of war, weren't there?
Yeah. In other cases, they treated them very well. You've seen Masters of the Air, right?
Bits of it, yeah.
Yeah. There's the episode where Alexander Jefferson, he's one of the Tuskegee Airmen, he arrives in the war camp, the prisoner of war camp. And at some point, one of the main characters, his name again escapes me, but he says to Alexander Jefferson, like, I knew you weren't a spy. And that is something that actually happened. It's also in the memoir of Alexander Jefferson, because the white prisoners of war, they wanted him to come bunk with them because they knew, like, he can never be a spy because in Germany there are no black people.
Yeah. Okay. And towards the end of the war, and you describe it in your book as the death of the Luftwaffe, their reputation built very solidly, didn't it? To the point at which many Allied pilots were very comfortable having them escort them, and in some instances particularly wanted them as part of their escort groups because they fought so fiercely.
Yes, and it's also part of the strategy that the Tuskegee Airmen employed because they stuck with the bombers. And some of the other fighter groups, they would go ahead and clear the path for the bombers. But the danger in it is that German fighters could slip through. So imagine like you're a couple of kilometers ahead and you miss a German fighter or a German fighter takes off later, he can directly attack the bombers. Whereas the Tuskegee Airmen, because they stuck close to the bombers, they could still offer protection.
And why was that, Samuel? Was that just their style and the way that they operated? Where did that come from? Why did they choose that tactic?
It's a good question. I must admit, I've read about this, but it's been a while. The idea is that there were a lot of losses sustained by the bombers, and one of the problems identified was that the white squadrons would rove ahead to clear the path for bombers, and that indeed left the bombers vulnerable to attacks by fighters that slipped through or they escaped detection or whatever. And to prevent the bomber losses, as far as I know, and I could be mistaken, so I must admit it, these guys stuck with them so they could protect the bombers.
Okay. And towards the end of the war in Europe, what happened to these pilots and squadrons at the end of the war in Europe? Were they posted to the Pacific?
In some cases, pilots returned. They were assigned to the 477th Bombardment Group. And this unit trained to be deployed in the Pacific. However, this wasn't the case for all of them. Some of them, after having finished their tour of combat, they could just return home or return to civilian life. And it was a bit of a complicated situation because although they had fought in combat and they had performed remarkable things, they weren't always recognized for their actions. I'm thinking about Joe Gomer. He was one of the Tuskegee Airmen, and when he returned home, he was told to get to the back of the line. So they were waiting to board a ship. And he says, like, okay, so the guy opposite of me telling us who can board, like, he never served in combat for a single day in his life. And then he tells me, a veteran who served in combat, like, you have to get to the back of the line because of his skin color.
Yeah. So when they were returning to particularly back to the States, a lot of those behaviors just returned. Did one question before we talk about the end of the conflict and how they returned to normal life. Many of them were decorated as well. There's a great picture in the book of, as you said, is Benjamin Davis. Sorry, the name escaped me. Decorating his son, I think it is. Yes. Wonderful picture, and receiving the DFC. Many of them received decorations, but again, not quite to the same level that some of the white pilots received.
Yes, and it's of course weird. Digressing into another topic, the recognition of Black American soldiers during the Second World War. There was also the investigation made after the Second World War about the Medal of Honor, how no Black American had earned the Medal of Honor during the Second World War. And
yeah,
the general belief at that time was that if a Black American soldier was awarded the Bronze Star, he had actually been recommended for the Silver Star. So they would take the they would take the award down one level. And yeah, I think it's a very complicated situation, because of course, like, to award a decoration is, there's a very human element to it. Like, you cannot quantify bravery. You cannot say like, oh, you have been so brave and you've been so brave. The general belief at that time was that indeed the pilots had been limited in some of their opportunities. You can also see it in that the 99 Fighter Squadron was employed as a ground attack unit. So certain units, when they engage in conflict, they were recognized by the amount of German aircraft that they shot down. So they would say like, oh, this unit shot down this many of the German fighters. And this is a very complicated situation for them, because the 99th Fighter Squadron was employed as a ground attack unit. So they would bomb targets for the infantry, or they would strafe certain convoys, bringing up supplies for the enemy. And yeah, it's still an important task, but it's not as glorious as taking down an enemy fighter.
It's
also one of the reasons why.
No, I was just going to say, when they returned, a lot of those, that recognition was not passed their way because of that sort of thing. They didn't shoot down lots of enemy aircraft because they were assigned a role that didn't allow them to. They were in aircraft that weren't really equipped to do that job when they were doing ground attack duties.
Yeah. It's also one of the complications. So there's no ace among the Tuskegee Airmen. There was no Tuskegee Airmen that shot down five enemy aircraft. And of course, there's various reasons for it. Also, one of the reasons is that by the end of the war, the Luftwaffe almost ceased to exist. Like, they were short of fuel, they were short of planes, they were short of pilots. And even if the men had the Tuskegee Airmen might have had the skill and the equipment to take down German aircraft, there were simply almost no German aircraft left to shoot down. Also in the ground attack role, they didn't encounter a lot of enemy fighters. And that's one of the reasons why the events on 27 and 28 January 1944 were so significant. On that day, they shot down, I believe, 12 or 13 German fighters in total. So on the first day, by chance, they encountered German aircraft dive bombing over Anzio. So the Allies had landed in Anzio. And by chance, they came across several German fighters that were bombing in the area, and the pilots engaged them immediately, and they shot down several of them. And later, the next day, they again shot down several German fighters. And it's been a tremendous shot in the arm, because in just 2 days, they could have shown everyone, like, hey, we can also take on German fighters, if there are any.
So, let's look back then. I mean, before I hit the record button, I was talking to you about how when historians look back, they look back through a particular lens. Want to put you a little bit on the spot and ask you for your opinion of the impact of, and we'll call them the Tuskegee Airmen, that whole group. What do you think their impact was on aviation and particularly on the Second World War? How do you look back? What's their legacy?
I'm mostly thinking of Benjamin O'Davies. We talked about him before, but I think that he's such a powerful person and he can be such an inspiration for other people. Like, you can endure if you dedicate your mind to it. And you should not, just because others don't support you, you shouldn't let it hold you back. As for their impact on aviation history, I think it's very big because they opened the door for black people to learn to fly. So the United States Army integrated after the Second World War, and beyond doubt, the performance of the Tuskegee Airmen has had a huge impact on it.
Wow.
So the white units, they had a certain standard, and the standard was immediately applied to the black units as well. So the black units were equal to the white units. And it's one of the arguments that they made, like, okay, so they have the same level of training, they have the same amount of skills as the white units, so the army should integrate, or the Air Force should make steps towards integration. As for their legacy, I think they have a very inspirational legacy, and I hope that other people feel inspired by it as well. And that's part of the reason why I also started writing this book. They had to endure a lot, but they succeeded in overcoming all the barriers, all the challenges, all the difficulties that other people put in their way.
Yeah. Certainly is for me. And just to personalize it a bit, some of our listeners will know my history and my father's history. I was really intrigued to see the little bit you put at the end when you talked about other allied forces, and you particularly mention British forces and black airmen in that as well. Do you just want to give us a little bit of a summary of that before we find out where we can get a copy of the book from?
So, in order to understand the futility of racism, because racism is just stupid, it doesn't serve any purpose, I thought it was interesting to compare it to how the British army fought and what the British Air Force did at that time. What I mean is that, so the British Empire at that time was very big, and it actively tried to use people in a certain way that they could use their talents in a beneficial way that everyone benefited.
Right.
I still think that I'm turning it into a horrible sentence. What I mean is that by employing people where their talents are best used, it's most beneficial for everyone.
Yeah. But I think it's also clear that, and as most people will know, there was endemic racism in an awful lot of the British military forces as well. And I particularly was interested because of my father's story, and in his operating unit, in his squadron, and particularly in his air crew, there was never any signs of that. It was a mixed crew, black and white, which was quite interesting. And I've never ever really thought about it that way, mixed crews. Goodness me, that would never have been able to operate for the Tuskegee Black Americans. But it was quite interesting just to get that balance at the end of the book. And it wraps the book up nicely to say, look, this isn't just something about the US black pilots or air crew. This was an issue for the world to face really at that time. So really, really interesting. Learned an awful lot more about some of those characters. There's a great deal in the book about some of the air battles. So some of the listeners will get their fix on aviation and fighter activity. It's really fascinating. Always, it's in the first tense as well, a lot of what you've put in the book, which makes it even more powerful. But where can we find a copy of the book, and how can we follow you online?
So for the British listeners, the book is available through Pen and Sword Publishing Company. So if you search for Pen and Sword Tuskegee Airmen, I'm sure that you'll find it. As for the American listeners, they can find it on Casemate. So if you look for Casemate Publishers, Pen and Sword, Casemate Publishers, Tuskegee Airmen, I'm sure you'll find it. As for everyone else, I would say Amazon is probably the best bet.
Right.
So Tuskegee Airmen, Samuel de Gorta, and I'm confident you'll find it. As for me personally, I'm on Facebook and I'm on Instagram. And as of today, I'm also on Threads.
Okay.
And you can find me at samuel.decorta. I hope we can leave a comment. So,
What I'll do, Samuel, is if you send those to me, I'll put them in the show notes for you so people can follow those links.
Yeah. What I do is I post every day an image or a photograph about a Black American soldier during the Second World War. And I try to do it to draw attention to the diversity of the past. That sounds very broad. But what I mean is that Black American soldiers did fight, and there were a lot of aspects to their service. So there were like certain quartermaster units, but there were also like shoe repair companies.
Yeah.
And they just repaired shoes, or there were salvage companies. And all of them have their unique history. Also, Black women served during the Second World War.
Yeah.
And I tried to make things more available for everyone.
Right.
Yeah, most of the listeners are from.
Well, we'll definitely put those links in. I didn't know that, so I'm going to now go away and follow you as well. And just personally, I want to thank you for the work that you're doing, Samuel, because I personally feel very passionate about the topic. And it's not to look back all the time and say what a terrible thing happened. It's more about now and understanding the impact on our world going forward. So for that, I thank you. That's great work, and thank you so much for spending some time with us.
All right, thank you for having me, and thank you everyone for listening, and I hope to see you all either on Instagram, on Facebook, or on Threads.
We'll definitely get the message out there. We definitely will. It we'd like to thank White Hearts and Mick Oakey at the Aviation Historian. You can find me at Nascot Hornet on Twitter. You can find Tim, Ellie, and Gareth on Extended's Twitter, Facebook, Threads, and Instagram feeds. That's it with the arrival of the music. It's goodbye from Samuel.
All right. Thank you all. Thank you again for listening, and thank you for having me on the show.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Remember, stay tuned to this frequency. That is, of course, Aerospace Radio Station Extended. Legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons license.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.